Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is deputy editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, it was short, but was it sweet? Simon and Lee pore over the details of the Chancellor's spring statement from National Insurance threshold rises to fuel duty cuts. Was there anything in there that will help the cost of living crisis now? Also today, should you invest in battery storage, the eye-watering cost of building work, and what's in an asking price? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, is that it? Shouted one, presumably Labour MP, during the Chancellor's spring statement about the help that had just been announced in the face of the cost of living crisis. Certainly a 5p cut in fuel duty, an extra £500 million for the poorest, and VAT off your solar panels wasn't going to cut it. But then, like any good Chancellor, he saved his rabbits, if we can call them that, until a bit later on. A raising of the national insurance threshold and a reduction of the basic rate of income tax by 1% in 2024. So Lee, did the Chancellor position himself as the true conservative low-tax Chancellor? Certainly, it unraveled somewhat, didn't it? There was a lot of backlash after the statement. Was it fair?
I think it's relatively fair, Georgie. I guess the way to really think about this and the backdrop in which this has been delivered, this spring statement, let's face it, we've had a pandemic for a couple of years. We've had the Ukraine crisis in the last sort of month or so. That's quite a tricky backdrop in which we've seen inflation soaring and we've seen this cost of living crisis rear its ugly head, all in the aftermath of basically the pandemic and then this Ukraine crisis. So that paints a picture of a difficult position in which to deliver a budget or a spring statement, as it were. Has the backlash been justified? Well, the big problem for Rishi Sunak and the government is the big debt pile that is building up. I mean, the debt interest alone, he warned, £85 billion. That's up four times compared to last year. Do you remember, at the beginning of the pandemic, I was talking about having sleepless nights, thinking about how we were going to pay for all of the measures that are coming. Well, here we go. Here's the problem that they have. And then the measures that have been announced, you know, do they go far enough? Well, the thing is, I always speak to friends, family, in the aftermath of these things. And they're on various levels of income. Some earn a lot of money, some don't earn a lot of money, all various. You know, I just like to get a barometer of how people feel. And the general consensus of this was just a bit of bafflement. And NI rise that comes in next week, then being the thresholds changing in July, that's puzzled.
Going up, then it's going down. You may pay less, you may not pay anything at all, but what?
Exactly. So that's puzzled people. That's definitely puzzled, I would say, argue the general public. They're kind of like, what?
Why did you do it? Why not hold off on the health and social care levy element, that 1.25%? Surely this is taking quite a lot of money out of the national insurance pot, as it were, that's going to pay for things like state pension and benefits and all that sort of thing. Why has he done it?
That's a very good question, Georgie. Why would you raise a tax and lower a tax at the same time? This has had many people scratching their heads. So instead of spiking the hike, which is what had been called for, to stop the extra 1.25% being added to national insurance altogether, which is to pay for the health and social care levy, as you said. Now, in the early years, that's going to go into the NHS and playing catch up. And then it's meant to go into social care. There's a deep level of concern amongst many people that it won't go into improving social care. It will just get swallowed up by the NHS. And that was going to raise £12 billion, estimated. Now, what he's done is instead of canning that, he's still planning on raising that money. So instead of saying, well, you know what? Actually, you know, we said we were going to sort out social care. We're not going to sort out social care anymore. And instead, what he's done is he has raised the threshold, which is an entirely sensible move because the threshold at which you started paying national insurance was about £9,600, whereas the threshold at which you start paying tax is about £12,500. So he's put those two in line with each other. And the effect of that is that once that kicks in, actually, some lower earners will pay less in national insurance, so mm-hmm. they will save some money, but higher earners will still pay more in national insurance. Over the course of a full year, and bear in mind this is coming in July rather than in April, the reason for that being that they said that was the minimum amount of time needed to give employers time to update their payroll systems, that they couldn't have done this from April. What it means is that over the course of a full year, the break even of where you end up either up or down is about £39,000 a year. So below £39,000, you'll end up slightly up compared to what you're paying now in national insurance. And above that, you'll end up down. But you won't end up as down as you were going to be. So for example, at the £50,000 level, you'd end up down about £9. Whereas previously, you would have ended up down, I think it was about 12 or something like that. Higher up the scale, the impact is greater. So for example, at £100,000, people were going to end up about £100 a month down. And now they're going to end up about £60 a month down. Extra 40 quid in their pockets, probably not going to massively help with their fuel bills. But these are the people who are in the best possible position to deal with their fuel bills. Obviously, it, as you said, and as Lee said, it's created some confusion and it's kind of left nobody happy. As Lee said, there's the barometer, the straw poll, the taking the temperature, whatever you want to call it. And what I got a sense of was people aren't happy that he hasn't done enough to help with the cost of living crisis. Whoop-de-doo. If I'm on £20,000, I'm going to save about £23, £22 a month on my national insurance. Well, that's really going to help me. And then higher up the scale, he's got people still complaining about the fact that he's putting up their taxes at a time when the cost of living is rising. And this is the worst possible time to be putting up their taxes and they're having to pay loads more for stuff. Even though actually what he's doing is putting up their taxes by less than he was planning on putting up their taxes. Would it have been better just to spike the hike? I don't know. I guess it depends, as I said, whether the money gets put to good use. And if I genuinely thought that we were going to really catch up with the NHS, sort the NHS out and then sort out social care, I'd be a lot happier about paying more tax. But I'm concerned this money's just going to get swallowed up and not really sort anything out.
One question I have is, can someone answer me why this was never proposed? Is it because it's an anti-Tory measure? But let's be honest, lots of these measures are at the moment. Why couldn't we have just raised the second chunk of national insurance? So the rate at which you currently pay national insurance, and correct my figures if I'm wrong here, 12% up until around 50 grand, and then beyond that is 2%. Now that's going up, of course, 1.25%. Why couldn't they have just kept the lower band the same and just raised the upper band to say, I don't know, 5%? Would that have worked?
It would have worked. The only problem is you've then got all of those people earning more than £50,000 paying 45% tax. I mean, their tax rate is double the basic rate of tax. And they also lose a lot of benefits that people below that level would get. So actually, if you look at the tax scale and how much people pay as their incomes go up, it is very progressive in the sense that they do definitely pay considerably more as their incomes rise. You do obviously reach a point where people start to earn so much that their tax rate starts to go down because they start to pay fancy accountants.
Or introduce a new chunk at the 150,000 level.
Maybe, but that, again, those people already pay 45%, but those people pay 45p tax, and plus the 2p national insurance are paying 47%. Or do you want to go back to a 50% tax rate? The argument actually is, and this is an argument put forward by the Institute for Fiscal Studies, the IFS, one of the most respected of the financial economist, that kind of area. Think tank, is that actually we are levying about as much tax on high earners as we can do, and that the tax base does need to be broader. It needs to be people lower down the scale paying a bit more as well. That sounds very unfair because those people have less money, but it does need to be broadened out. And actually, one of the biggest criticisms of this national insurance rise is that it's a national insurance rise, that it's not an income tax rise. Because by being a national insurance rise, it's not paid by the pensioners, for example. Yeah. Now, when we say pensioners is often used in conjunction with poor pensioners with no money, people who are struggling to get by on their meagre retirement income. There's lots of pensioners out there who have really quite healthy final salary pensions that are paying them out every month and have benefited hugely from that over the years in a way that younger people will not do in the sense that they have defined contribution pensions, where they're going to have to build up their own pot, rely on the vagaries of the stock market. They are having to pay a much greater income multiple for their homes. They're having to save much larger deposits. They've got all of these problems going on. And that because it's national insurance, those people are bearing the brunt of it. Whereas the people who are pensioners, for example, the people who are more likely to actually need health and social care aren't doing so. Now, that's a really difficult argument because, you know, someone in that position would say, well, I paid my taxes all my life and I worked hard and it's my money and I don't want the government taking it off me. Equally, someone who's 25 could say, I pay my taxes and I work really hard and I don't want the government taking it off me either. Unfortunately, the government has to take some money off some people in order to pay for this stuff, and it's getting more expensive. And they were brave to try to tackle it. Raising taxes is never popular. Rishi is a tax cutting chancellor, though, as he will tell you.
Allegedly.
So he's, as I said, he's both raising a tax and cutting it at the same time. The net effect of which is that it will pull in about 6 billion rather than 12 billion, and it will fall more on higher earners. So I don't know. Maybe that is fair.
Maybe it is. I was just proposing different solutions. But Lee, we also got the rather unusual, talking of tax cutting, decision to announce a tax cut that wouldn't happen for 2 years, if indeed it happens at all. However, very quickly that started to unravel as well when you think about pensions. Talk to us about cutting the income tax rate.
Yeah, well, this is another measure I think that people are kind of like, but that's in 2 years' time, and will that necessarily happen? And there's a cost of living crisis happening right now. I can't think ahead to 2 years' time.
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of like...
What was the point? Was that just a PR stunt, essentially?
What, Rishi said a PR stunt, you know, having his pre-photographs with all of his sheets of paper and the glossy photos there. Yeah. Having a shot at the Sainsbury's petrol garage with someone's borrowed Kia Rio, filling it up.
That
Chancellor.
Exactly right.
Was it a PR move? Well, you know, there was always that with George Osborne when he was Chancellor, that rabbit in the hat. You know, that was the kind of, it was like what he became sort of known for. And I think the pressure started to mount on him as more budgets went on, that there would be some sort of rabbit in the hat. And if the rabbit wasn't plump enough or fluffy enough, people weren't happy. You can see why this move, the timing of it, you know, because there will be another general election. As Simon says, Rishi wants to be seen as the tax-cutting chancellor, which is very difficult in a time in which that debt pile is mounting up and we've got all those pandemic measures to pay for. It's tricky. And will that 1 pence cut to 19 pence happen? You know,
who knows?
2 years feels so long away. I honestly mean, you think about the budgets and the mini statements and stuff that are to come before that. It felt kind of, I'm not going to use the word desperate because I think that's a bit too much, but it kind of felt like he wanted to end it with something that was a little bit more positive. But you can't underestimate the general public's kind of interest in things like tax, that kind of tax, even though it affects all of us and it affects what we get paid and all of that kind of thing. And people hear 1 pence income tax reduction and they go, I don't know. I don't think it's had the desired impact that he was hoping for. And actually in that same breath, the fuel duty cut. So, you know, the fuel duty's been at 57.95 pence since 2011, right? It's a big chunk of what we pay to fill up our cars and what businesses, you know, have to pay to fill up vehicles. That has been ingrained in my brain, you know, pretty much the whole time I've been a financial journalist, because that is it's all just been frozen ever since then. It's reduced that by 5 pence. So it's come down. But people, again, you know, the general consensus of what I've heard is, but petrol prices have gone up 5 pence.
And also you can be driving around and there's a difference of 10 pence. I mean, I haven't seen anything go down.
Yeah, it's true. And actually, the data actually suggests that it has come down. So beforehand, the RAC said a 5p reduction in fuel duty would mean 6p off the litre of fuel at the pumps. And you couldn't have just stood there at 6pm expecting that number to drop. Although Sainsbury's and Asda did promise to reduce it straight away. And when I drove past the local BP here, it had changed the next day. It was down 5p or so. And actually the data from Thursday, so the day after the budget, actually showed that averages had come down 2.5p. So the price of fuel had come down 2.5p on the Thursday, which actually is quite a big swing when you consider usually, even though prices have been going up, and they've been going up quite steadily, they've been going up 0.5p or 0.01p a day. 2.5p reduction in a day is fairly sizable, but does it go far enough for households that are feeling a pinch? And then there's a lot of people, especially lower income households, that don't even own a car. So it doesn't affect them whatsoever. And there's a lot of people that don't commute with cars. You know, so it's one of those really difficult balances, isn't it, as a chance of trying to get measures in that kind of help everyone.
Even that argument about even if you don't have a car, you'll still benefit from transportation of goods, etc., in your shops, those sorts of things. No, you're not convinced with that argument, Lee?
Well, this is a big hit for the Treasury to reduce fuel duty. You know, it's a massive money spinner for them. They make billions of pounds a year from fuel duty. And that was hit in the pandemic where people were using vehicles less. You could make that argument, but the trouble is fuel prices have gone up so astronomically in the last 2 months that I can't really see how that will filter through. It will take a while for that to filter through, I would imagine. And I just can't see it happening. And then you said earlier about, you know, have measures gone far enough for households to help households in this cost of living crisis? I think energy bills are obviously the big one, and we've had a raft of a package sort of announced for that already. And as I've made, I sound like basically like a broken record. Maybe you could start calling me broken record boys. But we kind of, I kind of keep on saying this argument that the problem isn't really right now because this price cap's coming in next week, which is going to be higher, but we're going to be using energy less because, you know, the weather will improve. It's in the autumn. It's when we get further down the line of what will the next price cap be? How much will the bills go up later in the year? I think that what the Chancellor is kind of hinting at is that there might be another package later in the year, depending on where energy prices are at. Because it's very volatile. It's very difficult to predict where prices are going and how events are going to unfold. He did announce an extra £500 million for this household support fund. Now, I'm going to hold my hands up here and say I don't know a huge amount about this. All I do know is that I've heard it's a bit of a postcode lottery. The money's
It's up to your local council, so you have to contact them to see what's being offered.
Exactly,
Who's eligible.
That's another £500 million, 50%.
Which doesn't even touch the surface, sorry, Lee.
It doesn't touch the sides, really, George. You know exactly that. I mean, £500 million, it sounds like a lot of money on paper, but the amount of people that help, it's just a drop in the ocean, as you say. 50% of that money is reserved for households with children. It can go towards things like food, clothes, and utilities. But, you know, I worry. And I worry more about later in the year. And as I say, I sound like a broken record, and I've said that numerous times, but I think later in the year, we've got a cost of living crisis on now. We've got inflation running at 6.2%, which was revealed before the spring statement. Apparently it's going to peak at 8.7% later in the year. I think it's going to be higher than that.
They
keep undercooking it. They keep undercooking this figure. You know, then that's the CPI measure. RPI measure is going to be more like 11%. What's the chance we're going to do about triple lock later on in the year? If you thought it was going to be high in the most... Well, that's another can that's going to be kicked down the road. And then we look at more devil in the detail of this. I think, for example, we're talking about younger people. Simon mentioned there about a 25-year-old. The student loan changes. Now, this was already announced, but some of the figures that were in this document show how much students are becoming cash cows, basically. So historically, tuition debt would be written off after 30 years. That's going up to 40 years. The salary threshold in which you start paying back your student loan is going down to 25 grand. But what was in this document is the fact that that's going to rake in £35 billion in the next 5 years for the Treasury. That's a huge sum.
Yeah, from students.
From students and people, graduates that you know, get into work. I mean, that's huge. And then I think I'll I'll mention one last thing that was in this, and then I'll pause for breath because I can feel myself. I can feel my blood pressure. I can feel myself pumping up. I feel like Rocky. I'm running up those steps. I think the most scary bit of information that was in this, and I tweeted this because I was actually quite shocked at just seeing this in a chart, is the disposable income chart. The disposable income chart that shows the worst slump in living standards since 1956. 2.2% less disposable income. The red candle on that graph did not look good. Has that been undercooked? You know, it's impossible to tell. It's going to be, and we've spoken about this for months. It's not like it's some sort of shock to the system seeing that stat. And I'd heard sort of murmurings of this a few months ago about, you know, how much disposable income was going to be reduced. But seeing it a little bit more starkly on this graph, I think it really hammered home just how difficult the rest of this year is going to be going into next year. And the roaring 20s, well.
Yeah, I know, right? We talk about this all the time, the cost of living crisis, but I'm not sure this is really the seriousness among many people as to how bad this is going to get. And I think it starts at the top. And that spring statement did nothing to say to people what potentially is coming down the road or is for many households already here. I just think it was so off the mark. And the fact that it was outlined, the three help schemes, one was the fuel duty, one was the household support, way underfunded. And the other one was VAT on things like solar panels. So that is amazing if you are a high earner, filling up your SUV and you're going to install some solar panels. For everybody else, you're stuffed.
I'm a little bit softer on that green energy stuff because some people will be influenced to get solar panels if, you know, anything that helps get solar panels. So if they're £1,000 cheaper, the cost of solar panels has come down vastly over the years anyway. Yes, there's not...
In this spring statement, wait till the budget. You know, this was almost something that should have been done in terms of emergency. We're in an emergency situation, aren't we?
Yeah, it's true. But we're also in an emergency situation in which energy costs are going through the roof, and any kind of measure that encourages people to get a renewable energy that can work and that becomes cheaper, to me, you know, yes, perhaps it wasn't the best timing to put it in there. But, you know, it's better to reduce it as soon as possible to get people encouraged to go out and get solar panels than not. But I totally understand what you're saying. You know,
I'm just stirring the pot there, Lee. I'm just stirring the pot.
The vast majority of people getting solar panels is so far down the list of priorities.
It's a 5% VAT cut anyway. As I said, I'm stirring the pot, but we don't want to go on about this forever. To be honest, we're going on about it longer than he actually spoke for. Simon, final word to you. Lee mentioned some economic calculations. We got some economic forecasts, some predictions, etc. How's it looking? I mean, look pretty good for employment figures, but for the rest, is it as bad as we're fearing?
So economically, this cost of living crisis is definitely going to affect us. The OBR has said UK GDP growth is forecast to be 3.8% this year. Now that would be a boom year at any other time, but it was forecast to be 6% as we rebound from the coronavirus pandemic. They're then talking 1.8%, 2.1%, and 1.8% the following 3 years, slightly down. Growth outlook has been lowered, but the employment market is expected to still be strong. That is actually one of the inflationary pressures coming through. There's concerns about this wage price spiral. Talking about a 7.4% inflation average over the course of the year. Public finances will worsen as the cost of financing debt grows, looking at about £83 billion a year, I think, to service the national debt, which is roughly level with the largest amount that goes into any single government department, which just shows how big it is. And then you come on to things like help for small businesses, the VAT cut for the hospitality industry that's been stopped and things like that, the effect of cutting national insurance and so on. And that will stimulate the economy slightly, some of those measures, whereas some of the measures have been taken away won't help, but they'll bring in a bit more tax compared to where we would have been with this cost of living crisis and squeeze going on. But we're not going to get back to the level that we would have been if all of a sudden this inflation bomb hadn't suddenly dropped on us. Now, the problem is that for many people, I think, as you said, the cost of living crunch is starting to be felt, but is not being felt fully yet. And I think we're going to reach the point over the rest of the course of the year where people are going to start to change their behavior. Businesses are going to start to change their behavior. Businesses are already trying to work out how they can give their staff anywhere near a pay rise that gets close to inflation. And most of them are just resigned to the fact that there's no way they're going to be able to give them an inflation matching pay rise, but that they're not going to, that they're going to have to give them a bit more than the 2% they might have otherwise got. So that's going to dampen businesses. And then the consumer spending element, people are going to find that they've got less money and the stuff that they're buying is going up in price by more. Energy bills for many people are not the biggest outlay in their monthly spending, but they also don't have a spare £100 a month to go on higher energy bills. And that's where it starts to kick in, is it doesn't matter what percentage of your overall spend it is and how much it works out as. The cold, hard reality of it is, do you have a spare £100 a month? Most people say, no, I don't have a spare £100 a month, and I don't have a spare £20 a month more, or £40, £50 a month more that's costing me to fill up my car. I don't have more money for my food shopping. I don't have more money for this, and I don't have more money for that. So just to go back to what you said, I think the fuel duty thing does genuinely help an awful lot of people. I understand that there are statistics that show there are lots of people on very low incomes who don't have cars and don't drive, but there are a huge amount of people in this country who rely on their car if they don't live in a major city. And in fact, basically, if you don't live in London, then the national insurance cut, it will help people a little bit, but realistically, it's not going to put that much money in their pocket, but it's not going to take as much out of it as it was going to either. The energy bills thing, I mean, it's so hard to work out what you can do about this one. Do you just give people money to just keep using the same amount of energy? Can they use less energy? Yes, we're going into a time when the weather is warmer and people will not need to heat their homes as much, but the vast majority of people's energy bills are smoothed out over the year. And so if you suddenly only start paying what you're using now, when the weather turns colder and the next energy price cap kicks in and all of a sudden your usage goes up, you're going to end up with a colossal monthly bill. So you might be better off just sticking with averaging it out over the year. Mm. But you can't average it out over the year because nobody knows how much it's going to go up by in 6 months' time. There are warnings that it could go up by 40%. But then I saw someone the other day say, actually, the price of gas has come down quite a bit from the peak. And if you look at the numbers now, might only be 15%. The problem is nobody knows, do they?
Indeed, they don't. Look, we'll leave that to one side, but we are going to pick up on the green energy theme, given we are all about to rush out and buy our solar panels, Lee. As interest in the renewable sector grows, so too do some of the options for savers to invest in. And a number of investment trusts are targeting an area of the market considered essential for the future of green power. That's energy storage. So, should you invest in batteries? Simon?
So, we are in the middle of the transition to net zero, which means that we are trying to decarbonize our economy, which means we need to find a way to have much cleaner energy. Renewable energy, solar, wind power, two obvious problems. Storing it. Sometimes you get lots of it, sometimes you don't get much of it. So it needs to be stored and it needs to be smoothed out, which is why we still rely on dirty energy, such as coal powered fire stations, in order to, and also our heavy reliance on gas in order to keep the lights on and keep the heating going. Now, the government would like us to shift away from gas boilers and towards electricity, which is going to see a huge increase in the demand for electricity. We're also being encouraged to switch away from petrol and diesel cars to electric cars, which again is going to see a huge increase in the demand for electricity. But we don't want to just create this electricity from dirty sources. We want to do it from renewable sources. And we don't have the money or the wherewithal to build enough nuclear power plants to cover us either. So what are we going to do? Well, we're going to need to come up with clever new ways of storing energy, which is where the battery storage investment play comes in. And there are out there clever companies who are getting involved in A, improving how you store energy, and B, creating an awful lot more capacity to do so. And there are a couple of investment trusts that enable you to invest in them. So the two leading the way are Gresham House Energy Storage and Gore Street Energy Storage. They've both got dividend yields above 5%, and they posted total returns of 23% and 20% respectively over the past year. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? There's another one as well that is a smaller one that's newer, and that is called Harmony Energy Income Trust. That's targeting a dividend yield of 8% per annum with a target total return of 10 to 12% a year. I mean, that sounds great, doesn't it? The thing is, these things are also quite popular at the moment and they trade at a premium. So you're going to end up paying more for the stake in the assets that your share entitles you to in terms of the share price. So Gresham House one trades at a 16% premium. The Gore Street one trades at a 9% premium, and the Harmony one trades close to NAV, but that reflects its kind of newer element. I think what's interesting about this is it takes the renewable energy investment picture on a step. A lot of the renewable energy investment so far has gone into solar and then some into wind as well. And investors are looking for other ways to try to take advantage of this shift to net zero and this shift to green energy. And clearly there's going to be much greater demand for the battery energy storage and on a mass scale, and somebody's going to have to provide that. And I think it's been made abundantly clear that the private sector is expected to do the hard running there. But as with any niche investment, it pays not to put all your eggs into one basket here. Now, these could do very, very well, these investment trusts. And they certainly have the wind behind them, or the wind in their sails, if you'll pardon the pun. But likewise, they're not a guarantee and you shouldn't stick all your money into them. But it might be a good place to put a bit of your portfolio if you think you want to profit from the transition to green energy.
Out of curiosity and very briefly, Simon, ESG has been going at a fair clip of late. And I'm wondering, because of the Ukraine war, with inflation running so high, you know, from consumer level all the way up to investor, do we care about green so much anymore?
I think we do
care.
We had
tears in Glasgow for COP26. And tears, Simon. Have those tears dried up?
Well, I think maybe we're slightly reassessing our priorities in the wake of the cost of living crisis that we just spent quite a lot of time talking about, and Russia's invasion of Ukraine that's causing even yet more disruption and also terrible impacts on people's lives. But I do think it's not going to go away, this shift to green energy and decarbonisation. We're not just going to stop doing it. We're not just going to go back to, you know, oh well, let's just make a mess.
Yeah.
There is, as I said, the wind in the sails of this kind of investment. It is a long-term scenario that you're looking at, where maybe the date for net zero shifts back, maybe the ambitions to hit net zero become hitting net zero plus a little bit or something like that. But we are going to continue moving in that direction.
Yeah.
I don't think we're just going to abandon it completely. And I think you need to, as an investor, unpick investments that are just having ESG slapped on them so that fund managers can sell them to investors and institutional investors, big pension funds and stuff, who want to make themselves look good, and investments that are actually backing, you know, an exciting part of the green economy that has a definite future.
Lee, just very briefly, with your consumer expert head on, do you think the drive to go green is waning? Do you think people will care as much with the cost of living crisis? It's not caring. Of course you care, but it's like whether you've got the money to do that.
Yeah, it's a really tricky question, that, because obviously the our sort of green viewpoint over the last few years has shifted somewhat. I feel like there has been a shift in almost sort of more people talking about it, thinking about it. We've had businesses, you know, definitely really jumping on board on this, and how much of it is greenwashing and how much of it is actual genuine changes that could help the planet, I don't know. But with the cost of living crisis, and as you say, you know, the Ukraine crisis that's going on, I think people might be reevaluating, you know, sort of things in their life. But I think, you know, that's a really tricky one to answer. But I think a lot of people, the majority of people, really care. I think they really want to do something, make changes that help. It's just how you go about doing it. So, you know, for example, like these heat pumps, we've spoken about this before. I'm just not convinced at the moment that the majority, even the minority of people are all that interested in getting one. So, yeah, I'm not sure. I'd like to think not, but probably.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on from that. If you are planning to renovate your home this year, watch out. You might want to get on YouTube, as some tradespeople have more than doubled their prices in the last 12 months. I'm joking about YouTube. Please don't do any of this building work yourself. But according to Checkatrade, the overall cost of carrying out home improvements increased by 61% between January 2021 and 2022. But some costs have risen even more than that. So Lee, what is the reason behind this?
This is definitely something that's been going on for a little while. Mm. The big thing behind it is simply demand. A lot of people, are requiring tradesmen to do all sorts of projects around the home, and that just bumps up price. I mean, I had some quotes for like decorators.
So they're just chancing it, Lee? Is that what they're doing? They're saying, well, there's a lot of people, you know, if you don't do it, bump it up, no?
Well, it's not just that. I mean, I think that's a tiny, tiny bit of it. I was desperate for a decorator. I needed to shift some rooms around in the house so my daughter could move into another room. I was given like 9-month waiting lists by people. You know, it's huge, the amount of work that people are doing around the house. But inflationary pressures, cost of materials is massive as well. You know, getting your hands on some of this stuff is not easy. So you spoke about 61%. There,
yeah,
record trade. So this is over 500,000 customer reviews to get an average price. So it's pretty comprehensive. Some of the costs of tradespeople for certain things is massive. The rise in the last year. For example, bricklaying is 103% more expensive than it was in January 2021. It's gone up to £1,851 on average. That's a that's an £829 increase. I mean, yeah, sorry, it was 1,636 bricklaying. But other things in here as well: roofing 91%, installing a fireplace or a stove 95%.
Youth,
and even a handyman. So again, recently we were getting quotes from handymen, and we had a guy came round, and he was well into his, I'm going to say late 60s, but he might have even been early 70s. He was a retired man from the city, and he was doing handyman job in the last couple of years because he said the demand was so strong and he can do all of these kind of jobs. He was telling me basically that he's got about 15, 20 jobs on the go for different houses. And he went around pricing up all the stuff that we needed doing. And, you know, these people are incredibly busy. It's incredible. Just how much of this goes, and he was going, you know, it's you millennials that can't do these jobs. And I'll be honest with you, I could probably do half of them, but it's just having the time, you know. It's like, and I just think, oh, I'll get a handyman around to come and do it. But the price of the average handyman is up 40% in a year.
What can you do though, Lee, apart from, as I said, go on YouTube and work out how to do it yourself? Which for some jobs, all right, but for most, I'd suggest, I'm not sure sticking a roof up with.
Well, there's not much you can do, Georgie, because a lot of these things, especially this job,
you've got to get the stuff as well, and that's
got to get the materials.
Exactly.
And, you know, I guess the only things you really can do, depending on what work it is that you want doing around the house, is trying to buy things that are secondhand or upcycled to get, you know, put into your home. The trouble is, it's always when you go and look for like a tradesperson, you never want to go for the lowest quote, and you never really want to go for someone that hasn't been from word of mouth or hasn't got the reviews to back up what they're saying. There's always that kind of like worry you're going to end up with someone that does a shonky job. Now, most tradespeople are professional and brilliant at what they do, and they can charge big prices because they are good at what they do. But what you can do to be honest, you've just got to suck it up, I think.
It's really hard because it's not like a lot of, you know, it's not like, I mean, of course, there'll be some people that want to renovate and they can happily live, you know, redecorating. It's a bit of a luxury if you can wait. I'm not saying it's not like, you know, Lee, obviously you want to get it. But my poor mum had a bit of a roof fall off there's no one around to fix it. There's a hole, which, you know, she's going to have to heat her house more than that, et cetera, et cetera. Costs go up. It's a tough time.
Yeah, my next door neighbour, a bit of the roof fell off. And I was speaking to her, you know, after that big storm the other week.
Mm.
And she's been waiting weeks for someone to come and show up and have a look at what to do. You know, because everyone is busy. That storm didn't help with things like that.
No,
you know,
not at all.
It was a busy old time for handymen, I'd imagine, in the aftermath of that. And I'm sure it still is now. I'm sure there's a lot of damage repairs that are required for that. It's a demand thing, and it's an inflation on materials thing. And everything is getting more expensive.
Yeah. Simon?
So if you need something done urgently or immediately, then yeah, it's really difficult because obviously you can't wait. The thing to do is just to find someone, you know, if you can, and then to stay on top of them. Don't be afraid to chase them up. Try to chase them up to get them around to look at that hole in your roof, to come and do that hole in your roof, because they're going to have other people chasing you. And sometimes I think with these things, you just need to have a bit of sharp elbows, being polite, being helpful, being friendly. And then, you know what, when you pay them, give them an extra 20 quid, say, here you go, thanks very much for sorting it out. Go have a drink on me, or have a couple of drinks on me. Because that means that next time they come round, they're going to be more likely to come round to you first. Okay, it's just cold hard reality, isn't it? And then if for a lot of other jobs, people are getting prices coming in that are absolutely shocking them. I was talking to someone the other day, and he got a quote for major building work. You know, major building work, and he had thought it was going to be X in the couple of £100,000 mark, and it was Y that was double it. And he's like, I mean, I'm going to have to get some more quotes. And if the rest of them come in like that, I'm just not going to be able to do it. There are lots of people putting off work at the moment, going, okay, well, look, you know, I'm just not going to do the work. And as Lee said, it's a product of a couple of things, demand and supply, and also the price of materials. The demand and supply thing is a lot of builders, especially good builders, good tradesmen, have got more work than they can possibly do at the moment. And so they're giving people prices, but sometimes they will be giving people prices in a sort of, I'm just going to give them a high price and price myself out of this work because I can't do this work. But then if they say yes to it, I'm going to take it, because if someone's going to pay me this amount of money, I might as well take it. And you've got to remember that the building industry is a highly cyclical industry. And those who working in it, who've been around the block a few times, will know that they go from years of feast to famine. And so they've got to make money when times are good, because if they don't make money when times are good, bad times are going to roll around again soon. Now, maybe with all of the inflation that we're suffering at the moment, the cost of living crunch and all this kind of stuff, it's going to dramatically slow down next year, perhaps. But, you know, maybe not. There's still a lot of people buying houses, and people buying houses dramatically increases work being done on houses. Then the other thing that's coming into play is the materials cost. If you get quotes for work from builders, tradespeople, from major jobs, they'll be giving you a quote for the cost of doing that job. Now, some of them have been caught out over the last year because the materials prices for doing it went haywire, and they still, obviously being honest, and decided to stick to their quote. I gave you the quote, we agreed the price, I'm going to stick to it. And they've had to suck up the extra cost of materials, which has eaten into their profits on previous jobs. So now on jobs that they're quoting for, they're giving themselves a bit of a buffer zone to make sure that A, that doesn't happen again, and B, they claw back a bit of that money. So maybe you need to speak to your builder or someone doing the work for you and talk to them about materials. Say, do you want to split out the quote for labor and the quote for materials? We agree the price for materials. And then if the price of the materials goes up, we share some of the pain there. You know, maybe you don't take on all of the extra cost. Maybe you take on 50% of it or something. And if you do something like that and you can lay out a plan where it doesn't look like your builder's going to get screwed over, if the price of materials keeps going up, but also you're not going to get screwed over by them just bundling it all into the same quote, that might be one of the best things that you can do. But it's definitely a lot harder to get quotes, get good people, and stick to budget.
Yeah, very sensible advice there, Simon. If you've just given up on the whole idea of renovation altogether and you want to move, here's the reader question for you. This is not me, obviously. Same old drill. We are planning on putting our home on the market soon. We've noticed that although most properties have an exact asking price, There are some that don't. For example, offers in excess of a specific price, a guide price or range, and even POA.
Not for the likes of you. If you have to ask, you can't afford it. Exactly. And we don't want people to know how much our house is going for and how much it's worth. The problem is with the property listing sites nowadays, it tends to appear adjacent to two other properties of similar value. Yeah. So you know exactly roughly how much it's on the market for.
So there you go, price on application. But they want to know, what is the point of the above listings, apart from the fact we don't want you to know how much it is, but whether there are any advantages of using pricing like this over the standard asking price, because they're thinking of putting their own home, obviously, on the market. What is the answer?
I always thought the answer was you just went with a straightforward asking price, and then you hoped that if things were good and somebody, and you got a couple of people bidding, that they bid it up and go above your asking price. And if, and most people would probably work on the basis that they can get a bit of money off, and it all depends on the market, your home, and the demand for it. And actually, you need to bear in mind, Henry Pryor said in this article, when he gave us some advice, that even in this red hot property market, only a very small percentage of homes sell for above the asking price. The offers in excess of thing, the idea there is that what you do is you put a lower asking price on it to attract people's attention. For example, you go 280 instead of 300, that pulls in people. But you say to them, by the way, guys, this isn't 280 and 5% off. This is 280 and upwards, to set expectations. I mean, obviously, if a property says offers in excess of, you can still make an offer below it as a buyer. It just all depends on what the market's like and how much you want that property and things like that. And then you get the guide price where they give you a sort of range. Always think that was a bit odd, because what if someone wants to pay above that range? What, are you limiting yourself? And then sometimes people give a guide price and they don't even give a range. They just give an individual price, to which you think, well, why didn't you just give a normal asking price? It's all trickery, really. Whether it gets you any more money at the end of the day, who knows?
Lee, any pearls to add to that?
It's just estate agent smoke and mirrors, isn't it? It's like, let's stick this on the listing to make it look a little bit different. I think the majority of home buyers just want to know what the price of the property is, right, and whether it's in their price range, and don't particularly want to play games in which it's a massive purchase, probably the biggest purchase you're ever going to make, you know, or one of many of the big purchases you're going to make if you're going up the ladder. I don't think people really want to go through. It's already difficult enough as it is. If you're going to house viewing, you want to know that it's within your budget. You want to know if there's going to be a little bit of wriggle room, how big the chain is and how desperate the sellers are. You don't want price on application, guide price, offers in excess of. It might work in the upper echelons of the property market if you've got a couple of million pound house and above, and that's how rich people operate, with private agents and all that kind of stuff. But in the regular run-of-the-mill property market, people just want straightforward numbers, figures. They don't want to be mucked around. They don't want to get into a bidding war and mucking around. But, at the moment, it's probably difficult not to get in a bidding war.
Exactly.
It's because of how many people are looking to buy and a short supply of homes for sale. But that said, I just think anything that kind of shrouds the process in mystery with a cloak of price on application, guide price, offers in excess of, is just pure hokum. Just give me the price to pay. I'm going to bid below it anyway, probably. Yeah. I'm going to then be told by the estate agent that there's someone else also interested in the property. I'm going to have to go to asking price and all that nonsense. Mm. So, don't put another layer of nonsense on it.
Sensible, Lee. Well, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest Breaking Money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join in the debate. In reader comments and find all podcasts past.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.